Revision Commission, January 9th, 1970. The schedule for today is sexual offenses, prostitution and related offenses, and abuse of public office.
Sometime, I believe in July, we approved most of the sections of the sexual offenses article. And at that time, or shortly thereafter, there was some question in our mind as to whether or not we should do something with respect to the sexual offenses or activities in those between 16 and 18. And we instructed Don to prepare some amendments, one of which was to raise the age from 16 to 18. Another one was to prepare an article on various types of delinquency and other activities. Now, Don's better able to explain these amendments and bring us up to date. Don, would you tell us what we had accomplished before, what your instructions were, what you have done, and then what the subcommittee has done with respect to this?
Right. All right, Mr. Chairman. Now, after that meeting, we had further work in the subcommittee, and the subcommittee decided on three basic changes to our preliminary draft number two. One was to amend the basic draft to add a section which was designated as sexual misconduct with a minor. And it was intended to cover and to protect the 16 to 18 year old age group with respect to sexual activity. And the other two amendments.
Don, pardon me for interrupting you. What is the present status of our law with respect to protection afforded to those between 16 and 18?
Well, we have a seldom used statute called fornication, which provides coverage for a victim who's more than 16, female who's more than 16 and less than 18, and a defendant who's over 18. Secondly, prior to the decision in State versus Hodges, which declared the contributing to the delinquency of a minor statute unconstitutional because of vagueness, we had that statute, which was really a broad catch-all type of coverage, which was an often used statute in the state to take care of the under 18-year-old age group. And what we were attempting to do with the amendment, which would appear to section 14 under preliminary draft number 3, was to cover that category of individual, to provide protection, but recognizing that inasmuch as the defendants or the victims in those cases were older, more mature presumably, that it was not necessary to characterize, for example, sexual intercourse with a girl who's 17 as statutory rape. In other words, we would still retain the age of consent for the purposes of statutory rape that we have in our present law. That is, age of consent would remain at 16. However, for the purposes of sexual conduct and violation of our section on sexual misconduct with a minor, the age was increased to 18. Now, what occurred at our meeting on December 13th, there was considerable discussion about this problem, and that discussion begins on page 51 of your minutes of December 13th. And the upshot of that discussion was that there was approved a motion to amend the sexual offenses article to make it a misdemeanor for persons under 18 to engage in sexual or deviant sexual intercourse. This then was my direction from the commission, and in attempting to accomplish this, I necessarily made some conforming changes to the draft, which appear in your book now as under your amendments. That's your first red tab in your notebook. And the beginning of sentences down to where it begins on page 53 are really just to make the rest of the draft conform to the direction to provide this kind of coverage for the 18-year-old adolescent. So what I did was to redesignate section 14 to take care of the individual, the victim, say, who is more than 16 but less than 18, from sexual imposition by a defendant who is more than 18, which is similar to our fornication statute and similar to what previously was the intent of our contributing statute. And then to redesignate section 15 and to continue that as the sexual misconduct statute to provide that the victim in that case is less than 18. So in as much as there is no age specified for the defendant, it would be broad enough to take defendants who are less than 18 who would fall without the coverage of, or outside of the coverage of section 14. The language in section 14 in the proposed amendment is the same insofar as the subsections are concerned as appeared previously in section 14 of preliminary draft number 2, except that the title of the offense has been redesignated as contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor, and the provision that a person 18 years of age or older commits this crime. If one, being a male, engages in sexual intercourse with a female less than 18, or being a female, she engages in sexual intercourse with a male less than 18, or the person he, which would take in both genders, male or female, engages in deviant sexual intercourse with another person less than 18 years of age, or causes that person to engage in deviant sexual intercourse. And then section 15, sexual misconduct, would provide that a person commits the crime of sexual misconduct if he engages in deviant sexual intercourse with an unmarried person less than 18. Now, hopefully that accomplishes with respect to the coverage of the minors, what the intent of the commission was.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question?
Yes.
I don't understand the difference between what was section 14 as of the 13th of December and what is section 14 now. In other words, page 53 of the draft and then page 1 of your amendment.
One thing is the defense, which appears in section 5, is deleted.
How is that deleted?
Well, it's an affirmative defense that there's less than 3 years difference, and we put that out in section 5, which is on page 21. That defense is not.
Well, section 5 is written still making the defense.
Well, the amendments changed.
The amendments, the first amendment, the first line of it.
Well, remember the amendment.
Under your first red tab.
I understand. I cleared my mind now.
So what you've done is remove the defense.
Yes.
Where's the defense, page 21?
Original section is on page 25.
Under the amendment, if a boy is 18 and the girl is 17 and they engage in sexual intercourse, it's contributing to the sexual delinquency of the minor.
Yes, it would.
And previously, as long as there was less than 3 years difference, consent would have been a defense.
Yes, would.
Okay, I understand.
Now, just to go on with the...
That's the only difference.
Yes. On page 2 of your amendments, we have section 16, and there was some discussion about the title of that offense. We formally called that soliciting, lewd solicitation, and there was some question that in as much as we've used the term solicitation as a word of art in our in court crimes, that I was directed to try to write a... the same statute with different language. The staff of the section on the accosting for the purposes.
Are those the only changes?
Yes.
What is the word accosting?
Well, the dictionary definition is to solicit for sexual purposes.
Oh, the word accost?
Yes.
I'm surprised.
You're going to
accosting people.
I've heard you the jury.
I thought it was an accounting jury.
What other changes are there?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there are no other changes except as mechanical changes. We've renumbered the section 16 that appeared in preliminary draft number 2 to read section 17, inasmuch as we had to add a section to attempt to conform to the amendment that was approved at the last meeting of the commission.
Actually, then, insofar as minors are concerned, what we have before us today is more restrictive than the existing law.
Yes, it is. Yes, it goes beyond our present law.
I mean, from the fact that before we had to show that the act of intercourse contributed to the delinquency or manifestly intended.
Well, I think we've got that advantage with this, because I don't think there'd be any problem with vagueness here, because in section 14, we specifically indicate what kind of acts you have to commit, which was the fatal problem with your contrib statute. But before, if you had a 17-year-old girl who was the victim and a 17-year-old boy who had intercourse with her, activity did not come within the definition of statutory rape. It did not come within the definition of fornication. And by case law would not amount to contributing to the delinquency of a minor. So with respect to sexual conduct in the age groups from over 16 and less than 18, we are more restrictive and have a broader coverage than we have
in our existing, that against law now.
We have in our existing.
Yes. Well,
what have we done with the kids where the boy is 17 and the girl is 16?
Be the same thing, because if she is less than 16, and he's 17, she would, as far as the victim's concerned, she would come within our third degree rape provision, but he'd be allowed a defense. He would be allowed a defense if he was less than 3 years older than her. We're not allowing this defense as far as contributing is concerned.
I know. My question is, if she's 16 and the boy is 17,
if she is 16.
Yeah, but he is not 18 years of age or older.
No, but section 15 would sexual misconduct. That was what I understood before. The amendment was to take care of that kind of situation.
Well, Don, the example that you used with the 17-year-old girl and the 17-year-old boy having intercourse, that's not covered by section 14.
No, but it would be covered. It would be covered by 15 amendments.
What that sexual misconduct does is make some sort of a crime, so to speak, so that a juvenile petition could be filed in juvenile court.
Well, it made it similarly under the other, except for the fact that you had the defense act.
Yes, right. We did allow the defense before. Under our preliminary draft number three, the defense would have been available if the defendant was less than 3 years older than the victim.
Presently, you have tell us why the court
cases. It doesn't cover it now. Fornication doesn't cover it unless the defendant is more than 18.
Seems to me that this is one of those areas the President's Crime Commission was talking about when they said a lot of things may not be nice, or they may even be evil, but they shouldn't necessarily be against the law. And I don't think the law is going to do anything in this area except butter up the books.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
this came up last time at the close of a rather long day, and in which I must say I thought we made excellent progress on less interesting drafts, and I do not mean to criticize anybody, least of all the staff, but I felt disappointed, not simply because my views didn't prevail, which they clearly didn't, but particularly because we had planned to talk about a different article, and instead last minute we talked about this article, and I personally felt that it was inappropriate, and I hope personally that somebody here, I don't know what the rules of this group may be with respect to reconsideration, but I would hope that somehow we could reconsider the matter, particularly we have nearly a full commission.
In what respect?
With respect to the basic policy of the motion which passed last time, number one, to remove consent as a defense, and number two, to add section what has been denominated section 15 in the amendment. I fully recognize that the motion has a lot to be said for it in practical terms and so on, but I honestly feel that that it is appropriate, if it's possible under the rules of this commission, for this decision to be reconsidered.
Well, let's see if we're clear on this. Your view is that we should reconsider this to readopt, I don't know if we adopted it, but to adopt the provision that allows consent as a defense?
In other words, it was a basic policy question whether we should stay with what is preliminary draft number three in the teenage area, or whether we should go to what is comprehended by these two amendments. And it'd be roughly the 16 to 18 year olds and the consent and so on. And I think it's a clear policy question.
Well, I just have a feeling that really this change that we have made here, insofar as concerns, and I may be old fashioned and maybe I'm wrong, but insofar as concerns the ability of parents to control their children, and it seems to us that today they are perhaps a little bit more wayward, not wayward as much as their reaction toward something of this sort is different. I think that this will constitute a vehicle whereby parents can exercise better control over their children, because they'll be in a position to say to them, not as they do today, well, you poor thing, these things happen all the time. They can say, this is a crime for this to have happened. But if you wish to make a motion to reconsider, we'll certainly entertain it.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make the motion, because I voted on the prevailing side. I want to make it clear I'm going to vote no on the motion, because I did make the original motion. I agree with you, Mr. Chairman. I think there's two other considerations that ought to be taken into account. One is that I think that in this article, we're going a long way in changing the law, an area which I think is much more important. We are basically removing criminal sanctions to conduct between consenting adults. I think we've got to be realistic. Bite off more than you chew. Secondly, I think there's also an opinion on the part of the public that criminal law should, to some extent, state our basic moral codes. And secondly, I think parents would like to feel reassured that society as a whole is going to help them try to control this kind of conduct. I certainly prefer to acknowledge it would be, to a great extent, unenforceable, but
is there a second to the motion?
I'll second it, Mr. Chairman.
Wally.
For the record, I think we had I'll fail to staff up. The idea to bring this up the last meeting was not the staff's, it was mine as the chairman of the subcommittee that this came from, and the only intent at that time was to add the small section that picks up the sexual misconduct area. But like the policy and evidence, once the door is open, this one blew open, and we got into other areas. But it should be clearly understood that this was not a staff thought.
No.
This is mine.
Well, they were directed.
Your friendly attorney general.
Yes, the wisdom of it now is seriously in doubt, but at that time, it was propitious. Well, Mr. Chairman, I simply desire to say further that, though I don't intend to make a long speech here, because we canvassed it last time, and we had been over some of the same area last July. But I can't help but feel that it would be dreadfully unfortunate for adults to pass a law which they say they will use talk to the teenagers about, and in the very same breath admit that it is virtually unenforceable. And one of the things I had understood we were trying to do throughout the whole code is to do away with statutes which are largely unenforceable, and when they are enforced, can't help but give rise to charges of selective enforcement and all of the evils that go with that. And it simply seems to me that the area of teenage sexual experimentation, as I think one of the euphemisms was last time we mentioned, that if it is appropriate for a 21-year-old sexually to experiment, honestly can't see that society is well served by passing a law which it admits it won't enforce and can't enforce, probably, and if so, only selectively, that the same conduct is denied those.
Well, Jim, may I ask a question? Why is it unenforceable? Tell us why.
Well,
that's the basic assumption of the argument. Why is it?
Well, I don't know how you go about enforcing it. Portland, for example, with a vice squad of relatively limited numbers who spend their time in the narcotics section looking for narcotics and the vice section looking for professional prostitutes. Only maybe some enthusiastic deputy is circling Council Crest or something and happens upon teenagers who are experimenting sexually, and he might make an arrest.
That can be said for every crime that's committed.
Gambling.
But at the same time,
is awful tough to enforce.
Well,
at the same time, we pick an arbitrary age for 16 statutory rape that we have now. There isn't anything magic about that particular age, yet we selected it.
Well, you have this in any age differential.
But even if there are limited enforcement officers so that they can't apprehend every act of this sort, and obviously they'll the percentage will be extremely small, less than 1% perhaps. But nevertheless, the fact that it is here and that it is enforced when it is observed, it seems to me that that in and of itself will provide a tool whereby some additional control can be maintained over those in those age groups.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
First of all, I don't think anybody's virginity is going to be protected by such a statute. Secondly, I don't think that any law enforcement agency that is in Oregon, for instance, I don't think the state police, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, the Portland Police Department would have, as a matter of enforcement policy, making arrests in these cases. I think if there would be one of those areas, they just sat aside and ignore it.
Well, you don't know. You think that.
Well,
they'd be violating their duty if they did it.
If you were
an officer, do you think that, would you enforce it?
No.
Well, what, would you feel badly if you got canned because you refused to enforce the law? I'd say you should be.
There's an assumption that the police enforce all the law, and this is totally erroneous. They don't. It would be utterly impossible.
Well, of course it's impossible.
What you're saying is that the selective enforcement that Judge Burns decries as a practical matter is carried on all the time.
It is.
My opinion.
Well, that quota only relates to the Portland Police Department, not the Randall County. Is that right?
I can show you some police departments and some sheriff's offices in the state that would enforce it. And I think this is going to be a problem all the way through this whole business, the criminal statutes that some police departments are going to make arrests and others are not, and some district attorneys are going to prosecute and others are not. And
I wouldn't tie up an urban police department running around chaperoning kids. I just that there's much more important
decisions for the people who run the urban police department, because there are lots of suburban and non-urban police departments.
Mr. Spalding.
I think there's another consideration here that this conduct in some of these areas, of these age areas, I mean, has from time immemorial been taken care of by criminal law, at least on the books. And if we let it be necessarily publicized that we have decided that this is for once and first time no longer criminally sanctioned, that to the kids is a hell of an argument that now they have a license, which will be very detrimental to the welfare of society.
I agree. Wally Carson.
Three things. I think, first of all, I don't think we have to project what the police would do. I think we can look at what they've done under fornication. And I ask any of you to check with your sheriffs, your district attorneys, and find where anybody in the last 15 years has been charged with fornication. So if past history is correct, we can assume this is not going on because nobody's been charged with it or prosecuted. And so
that covered the fornication, and that was what your fornication was always charged in.
I'm well aware of that.
Now, and since it's unconstitutional, we have yet, at least that I know of, had a fornication file.
Okay.
But that's only after the contributing statute was lost, then the only time you can really talk about fornication.
All right. I'll ask perhaps Frank, how many, since the contributing statute has been unconstitutional some 6 months ago, I presume that there's been no fornication on the Oregon State campus or any place around there, because I'm unaware of Fenton County. You can respond.
Well, since the contributing statute, we've only had one narcotics arrest on the Oregon State University campus, too. And that doesn't mean that there's not narcotics going on up there either.
Well,
all right, complete your statement, Dan.
All right. I won't regale you with my vehemence in this area.
Please do.
As I've done several occasions before. Secondly, I frankly object to having the criminal code be the explanation for parents. One of our members indicated that the parents, and I've heard this before, that the parents can point to their child and say, don't do that, that's a crime. If we really believe that's the purpose of the criminal code, to control children by saying, no, don't do it because it's wrong, or don't do it because mom says it's wrong, but because it's a crime, then my God, we can improve society immensely. We can get them all sorts of good things we can back up parents with. And I don't view the function of criminal law is a modern day Dr. Spock. I don't really think it is.
I agree with you, but nevertheless, you'll have to admit that if this is a benefit that derives from the passage of this thing, we shouldn't sit here and overlook that either.
I agree, but it shouldn't be the reason for passing it, to back up parents. If it's a benefit, and I agree, I'm not arguing that it's not there. It is there, clearly. because some parents unfortunately say, don't speed, because it's a crime.
And with some kids, it works.
Yeah. It's not working very well.
When your fourth teenager comes in and tells you he wants to start experimenting with some marijuana.
Well, frankly, as a matter of fact, if my answer to him was, Scott, don't do it, it's against the law, and I got to go to the ball game, see you later, then my God, my family's in more trouble than the district attorney in Marion County's ever
solved. Yeah, you should give up that ball game.
You're right, and I should sit down, and I shouldn't rely on the criminal law and the district attorney to do my upbringing.
My kids smarter than I am.
Yeah,
well, that's the problem I've got to have. Yeah,
but you get the reverse.
Sure, you tell your kids, well, this is wrong, and they'll say to themselves, oh, they have no passion. The criminal law commission said it wasn't.
All right, let's turn it the other way around. We'll say it's wrong, and they'll point out to us the hypocrisy that the criminal law revision in 1969 and 70 is building into it when we sit around and say, perhaps it's not going to be enforced, but we ought to have it anyway, so we can point to it. And one of the loudest things that's shrieking to me by young kids, by the silent Americans, and by everybody else is that, my gosh, if the law isn't going to be enforced, let's not have it, this selective enforcement. We ought to do what you and Don are talking about. If the legislature passes a law, the law enforcement officer doesn't, we either ought to repeal the law or fire the law enforcement officer, having a whole bag of laws that's in the back of the book that may be enforced depending on public opinion.
Well, if it helps in 5% of the cases with children, I think it's justified. If 95% of them ignore it, but if this provides something for the parents to control those children in only 5% of the cases, then if we don't go through with it, I think that we are doing an injustice to society as a whole.
Well, yeah. We have a number of areas in the law, and we vote on programs in this legislature, which are selective enforcement programs. The police make these decisions day in and day out on the basis of selective enforcement as a deterrent. But I think there are some legitimate situations that I think this statute does cover. Suppose you've got the situation with a girl with 10 or 15 guys. She's consenting. I think there's good reason that in that type of situation that these people do be turned over to juvenile court. And I think it is an appropriate, very appropriate place. I can't imagine any officer who came across that situation just standing there and walking away.
But if the girl's under 18 and the boys are over, they're not going to turn the girl over, they're going to turn the boys over.
Bob Chandler?
Chairman, we discussed this, most of us, 9 of the 13 members of the commission were here the last time we voted on this matter, and we have 11 of the 13 here now, 12, and I don't think anybody's going to change any mind, so I'll call for a question on Mr. Johnson's motion.
Question's been called for. This is on the motion to reconsider. All those in favor of reconsidering will say aye. Those opposed, no. Call roll.
No.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Sandra Burns?
Aye. No, explain my vote.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
No.
Clark?
Yes.
Frost?
Aye.
Hawes? Jernstead?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Knight?
No.
Spalding?
No.
Young?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
No. Motion is defeated. Do you wish to explain your vote?
If it had been reconsidered, I would have spoken against it and voted against it, but I felt that I voted in favor of reconsidering it because there were one or two that were not here at this last time, and I thought that it would be healthy for the commission to fully air and discuss it now. I also felt that we possibly are losing sight of one fact, and that is that whatever we do today and tomorrow and later this month with respect to these tentative drafts, they're just that. They're tentative drafts that are going to go out into public hearings around the state. We're going to have an opportunity at the conclusion of those hearings to review and weigh both our work and the evidence that's been submitted to us, and I think that's an important consideration.
My reason was that Carson was getting mad, and I thought he'd get madder.
You missed a real show last time. I think those who were there will note my marked coolness in comparison.
Mr. Chairman, would a motion then be in order to approve the amendments as drafted?
Yes, it would be in order. Section
I make, I so move.
Sorry. 14, 15, 16. Is there any further discussion? Not, the clerk will call a roll.
Judge Burns?
No.
Cindy Burns?
Aye.
Carson?
No.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
No.
Frost?
No.
Jernstead?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Spalding?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion is carried.
Chairman, is it in order to move the adoption of the entire article?
Yes, I think
you're rolling in the power,
aren't you? I'm trying to get something. I think that's our next step. Motion has been made. Is there a second?
I'll second.
I second.
Any discussion? Question? Clerk will call a roll.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Senator Burns?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
No.
Frost?
Aye.
Hawes? Jernstein?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
No.
Bobby?
Aye.
Yeah?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Would you care to explain your motion?
Again? Well, I think my objection to the sexual offense thing is probably already in the record in my votes and prior to we were considering it, and I'm trying to be consistent.
Let's check that out.
Mr. Chairman, we find the commission's finally shown that a bunch of impudent snobs on that subcommittee. That
Well, I'm glad you finally got that out. I've been waiting for 2 hours.
Bob, I'll put it this way, that I wasn't a feet snob. I'm no longer a feet. I had to get Vern to tell me how to pronounce the feet this morning.
Can we turn to prostitution?
All right, good.
I'll add
this is also subcommittee number 2.
You didn't have to start it that way.
I move we approve the whole darn thing. Now that we're rolling.
I move we have a public hearing on this conducted by the subcommittee in Marion County in the first week of May. Strike that.
Mr. Wallingford. Mr. Wallingford was reporter for this grant.
I brought your bill.
Well, I had a meeting about a month ago with four members of Fulton Price Squad who specialize in prostitution investigation in Judge Burns' chambers. And they had reviewed our prostitution draft and they had some suggestions.
Oh, my, there's something like that.
Recommendations to make. Now, Judge Burns kept notes during that meeting, which I did not. So, we had a meeting about a month ago with four members of the Portland Vice Squad who specialize in prostitution investigations.
And Judge Burns James.
Yeah.
This is where I specialize.
What does go on?
Well, I'm suitably close to third, southwest third, and salmon. Considered to be one of the.
Anyway, since Judge Burns has the comprehensive notes and I have none, I would suggest that as we reach each area that they were interested in, that he bring their recommendations up.
Start with the title, I suppose.
Now, I would suggest that we skip the section 1, the definitions, and start with section 2, and we can refer back to the definitions as they're used.
Staff's getting pretty wise on that, Mr. Chairman. You know, they're doing that every time to us.
So section 2 is on page 3. And section 2 is the basic prostitution offense as it relates to the prostitute herself or himself. And the crime is stated thusly: a person commits the crime of prostitution if he engages in or offers or agrees to engage in sexual conduct in return for a fee. Sexual conduct is defined in section 1, subsection 6, as meaning sexual intercourse and deviant sexual intercourse. And those two terms are defined exactly the same as they are in the article on sexual offenses.
That word he, of course, is all inclusive under our definition. This kind
yes,
of
that is the one substantial change in existing law. We would this law would apply equally to the male or the female prostitutes.
We don't have to say he, she, or he.
No, we don't. We don't, because under ORS, under chapter 174, ORS, general statutory construction, he means female, male, or the neuter.
Simply using this as an example, if Chandler walked up to some female and said, for $5, I'll go, he's guilty of prostitution.
You mean you're talking about the patron?
No, I'm just talking about Chandler.
And he offers to.
Well, that's an offer.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
This is intended, the language, in return for a fee, to apply only to the prostitute who was accepting the consideration. Because in subcommittee, we considered a section on patronizing a prostitute, which would have made it a crime to patronize a prostitute.
You misunderstood the term.
Yeah,
I don't think that's what you meant.
Yeah. Man walks up to a lady and says, if you'll give me $5, why, I'll perform.
Yes, that would be a crime under this section.
As soon as you depersonalized it, Mr. Chairman,
yeah,
well, they got
the
point. I just couldn't understand it.
What's a fee?
$5. Yeah. Doesn't have to be money.
Well, this is one of the points, interestingly enough, Mr. Chairman, that the fellows in the Vice Squad mentioned, was whether or not the fee was broad enough to comprehend a credit card. Because apparently, some of the more sophisticated circles.
The Bank of America.
The Bank of America card is just as good as a $10 bill or $20 bill or whatever. And they did mention this as one thing, and it seems to me that as I understand from what Roger said, that the fee would be broad enough to comprehend any medium of payment.
Talking about consideration.
Yeah, well, wouldn't it be plainer to say monetary consideration?
Doesn't
have to be monetary. How about a promise of marriage?
No,
it isn't.
How about a month's rent on an apartment?
That's a real fee.
Yeah, really.
Do other states use fee?
Yes.
And I suppose that there's we have a definition for fee.
No, we don't define fee.
Do the cases define it pretty well?
There are no Oregon cases that define it because it is used.
Well, the
commentary.
They say in the commentary on page 7, the term for money may be unduly restrictive in view of other forms of valuable consideration that may bind the transaction. I think it means money or any other valuable consideration.
Well, it just seems to me, why don't we say it that way instead of calling it fee?
Valuable consideration.
That's a dinner?
Yeah.
Well, what about the expression we used last night in the article we were working on where a monetary or other valuable consideration?
Let's hear the other side of it. Why do you still feel that fee is the best terminology, Roger?
Well, I don't necessarily think it's the best.
Well, it
is intended, it's been used here, and I think it's probably defined as such in the dictionary to mean any monetary or other consideration.
Let's see, California says money, New York says fee, Michigan says fee.
And it suggests more of a business transaction type.
Does this get ourselves into a situation of implied contract? Young bachelor takes the girl out for dinner? Both of them know where it's going to end up. She accepts it, and it's just like jumping into a taxi cab and saying, take me to second note.
Well,
I promise a payment, which then becomes a fee.
offers or agrees, third and yeah. quietly, huh?
Well, does it conclude that? Should we say a present consideration or express promise of valuable consideration?
Well, that's what we're talking about.
Well, you'd have to prove that this was given and received for this purpose. Supposedly the dinner wasn't eaten.
It was for gastronomic delight.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not so sure of it, so I may not have been particularly hungry.
Yeah. We also might
not
get
for steak and lobster, anyway.
We might have problems with failure consideration, too.
Dave, I think the answer probably is that there wouldn't be any prosecutions under your hypothetical.
You trust the prosecution.
We're back to selective prosecution.
That's the way it is now. Have you ever been prosecuted for...
Keep going.
I'd like to mention one thing, too. What we've attempted to do throughout our revision is when we're drafting a section, particularly where we're looking to the New York Code, for example, or the Michigan Code, not that we feel there's any particular magic in their language, but unless we feel that there is some overriding consideration, and I'm talking about the staff now, or the reporter, on a particular article, we have tried to conform to that language in as much as we feel that if and when these statutes or these proposed statutes become law, that the experience, the court experience in these other states is going to be very helpful in this state in construing our own code, and that we've tried not to change just for the sake of change, unless, like I say, we feel that there's some problem there, because a heavy populated state like New York or Michigan, where there's a great amount of litigation in the criminal courts, I think is going to be of great value later on in this state in looking to their case decisions.
And they used to be?
Yes.
So well, by the way, it's not a fee simple, it's a fee tale.
Webster defines fee as a heritable land held from a feudal lord in return for a service. That gets you out of your problem, Dave.
In return for service.
Mr. Falling and I told on the Supreme Court justice last night, really not paying attention to what statutes the way we were writing, but to really read the commentary. I pulled the commentary up covered in this case.
I'll move the adoption of Section 2.
You've heard the motion. Any further discussion? Call the roll.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Sandra Burns?
Aye.
Carson? Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Frost?
I'm sorry, could you state the question?
Section 2.
Adoption of.
As is?
Yeah.
Aye.
Jernstedt?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Spaulding?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
Voting.
Section 3.
Page 12. Section 3 is titled Promoting Prostitution. And this is designed to reach the people and profit from this use of prostitution.
Now, is it anticipated the rest of this law on prostitution is more serious than is Section 2?
Yes. What we're talking about in Section 3 is commonly referred to as the handler, pimp, madam. The person commits the crime of promoting prostitution if, with intent to promote prostitution, he knowingly, one, owns, controls, manages, supervises, or otherwise maintains a place of prostitution or a prostitution enterprise. Those two terms, a place of prostitution and a prostitution enterprise, are defined Section 1. Sub 2, induces or causes a person to engage in prostitution or to remain in a place of prostitution. 3, receives or agrees to receive money or other property other than as a prostitute being compensated for personally rendered prostitution services
pursuant to an agreement or understanding that such money or other property is derived from a prostitution activity. And four, engages in any conduct that institutes, aids, or facilitates an act or enterprise of prostitution.
Roger, how far does sub 4 go on this? Would this apply to the owner of the apartment house?
Yeah, that issue was raised in subcommittee, and that's why we've added the language in the first paragraph requiring an intent to promote prostitution. Particularly in regard to number 1 and number 4, because number 4 we were concerned about, it would cover, for example, a taxi cab driver who takes a fare to a house of prostitution, knowing the purpose of the fare, knowing it's a house of prostitution, but having no personal interest in the transaction itself.
Important owner with 6 months lease, they afford quite
slick. Which one do
you want? Well, I wanted my lift. There are 3 girls and their boyfriend who are running a house.
He's still not promoting
it. He better kick him out.
Well, of course, we do have a civil procedure for abatement. And also, I think you could show that if we were charging a sovereign rent or other facts, you might be able to show an intent to promote prostitution. We were concerned in number 1 on protecting the hotel clerk, for example, who just a straight employee, goes out, checks people in and out, has no particular intent.
But knows that it's going on.
Either knows or has a strong suspicion.
As I understand, subsection 1, the person, the absentee landlord, for example, owns a building, still protect what it does, so you've got to prove an intent.
Now those two terms are defined in section 1. A prostitution enterprise is an arrangement whereby two or more prostitutes are organized to conduct prostitution activities. And we're talking there primarily about him who operates a string of girls, not necessarily any fixed sites. The place of prostitution means any place where prostitution is practiced, and that's the fixed situs type.
Well, why do you have to have a prostituting enterprise? You have two or more prostitutes.
We're rid of the enterprising right.
Do you mean that you could have a prostitution enterprise if I only have one girl work for you?
Yeah, and I think you may have, I think sometimes you may be able to, you may suspect that he's got a string of girls, but he's only got one that he keeps there at a time, and you may only be able to prove the one.
Well, I think that the one individual would be covered under subsection 4, I believe, wouldn't it?
It could be. It also could be covered by subsection 2, the typical pimp, ordinarily.
Well, I just don't see why you would limit a prostitution enterprise to, because...
Well, wouldn't it be included under the phrase place of prostitution?
If she was working out of fixed sites.
Yeah.
Well, and 4 also covers engaged in any conduct that facilitates an act of prostitution. So,
act or enterprise.
Sure.
I think most prostitution in Oregon today, for example, Multnomah County, would counter the definition of a prostitution enterprise rather than a place of prostitution.
Yeah, but Lee's point is that maybe the DA can't prove it, but he could prove one,
Yeah, and certainly there wasn't any intent to leave that kind of situation out, but I think it is covered.
Well, I do. The only thing is, it just doesn't seem to me in a prostitution enterprise, you say maintains a place of prostitution, someone who supervises a prostitution enterprise. Well, I'm assuming there you're talking about the kind of operation that you don't have any actual. Do it out in the park or somewhere else, but I don't see why you would want to limit the word prostitution enterprise to 2 or more.
Well, doesn't the act immediately, the act or act space or space enterprise?
fulfill the same need. If you approve one individual case law, act would cover two while you've got an enterprise.
If you can prove there's one girl in 10 rooms, that would be circumstantial evidence that it's probably worth one gal.
Well, suppose you got the situation where you've got a gal, you stash her out in some secluded spot, but it's a public property or something else, and you're out drumming up business for her, and maybe you've got a bunch of girls who are working this way. Why would you? I mean, that's an enterprise. You don't have any. You don't own or control or manage or supervise a place of prostitution.
Yeah, but you facilitate an act of prostitution.
You institute, aid, or facilitate an act of prostitution, don't you? Section 4.
Well, I agree. It seems to me why. Now, one, you're talking about a prostitution enterprise. It seems to me a prostitution enterprise could involve one girl or involve five. It doesn't make much difference.
I agree.
Oh, I think it's any
more. But I don't see the value of calling one prostitute an enterprise when you have her otherwise covered in your statute.
I think the typical.
You just don't want to dignify it by saying the guy only has one girl. It really isn't very enterprising.
It would be covered under all four subsections. I think the typical. The typical pimp actually violates every one of these four sections.
Yeah. I have a technical question, Mr. Chairman.
I'll take those last votes were any indication of the way today is going. In other words.
Yeah, I know.
The
question is, and I sat in on the conference with Roger and heard all the lurid stories by the vice officer. ORS 167140 relates to the sufficiency of the female's testimony in this kind of a prosecution. Now, we repeal that by Section 3. Can we pick that up someplace else? What one is it?
Will you pick it up?
All right.
Section 5.
All right. Now, the other question is, as I recall, this Chapter 400 section relates to the abatement of the house where it's used for prostitution purposes. Is that right?
Yes, that was amended in the
amended in 1969. Now, can we pick that up someplace? That's a pretty useful tool for law enforcement.
We're not intending to repeal that.
You are not?
No.
Okay. I think we might have some difficulty insofar as gradingness is concerned, but that's a decision to be made later. I think it's a pretty good section. I'll move and we adopt it.
I have a question. Does Section 2 and 4 here, will they cover the person who uses the prostitute?
In the commentary, I point out that it's not intended. None of these sections are intended to reach the patron.
But certainly the patron would be engaging in conduct that aids an act of prostitution.
But you have to have the intent to promote prostitution. And discussed in subcommittee, we discussed a specific section dealing with soliciting a prostitute. Or patronizing a prostitute.
They had a section in the original draft which was taken out.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about is the making this person an accomplice, therefore having to corroborate the testimony and all that type of thing.
He's not, because under our draft on parties to crime, we specifically exclude this kind of individual because his conduct is necessarily incidental to the commission of the offense, and he is not an accomplice under our definition of that term in our proposal on accomplice.
I move the adoption of the section.
Second.
Any discussion?
Judge Burns removed Senator Burns' motion.
This is removed.
Call the read.
Call roll.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Senator Burns.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Chandler.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Frost.
Aye.
Pons. Durnstead.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Spalding.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. King.
Aye. Next section.
Section 4 is on page 24.
Mr. Chairman, may I have the concession to collect and reprint in a suitable anthology anonymously all the notes that passed back and forth?
No.
I can guarantee enough royalties to fund this committee for another 2 years.
Section 4.
Section 4, compelling prostitution. This offense is another form of promoting prostitution, but in areas where the conduct is considered more serious, and it's anticipated that Section 4 would be graded as more higher penalty than Section 3. A person commits the crime of compelling prostitution if he knowingly, one, uses force or intimidation to compel another to engage in prostitution. Two, induces or causes a person under the age of 18 to engage in prostitution. Or three, induces or causes his wife, child, or stepchild to engage in prostitution.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Do you think, it's kind of a philosophy question, do you think that the guy that uses force is worse than the guy that lives off the earnings? Of course, it's implicitly he's receiving the earnings.
I think so, because I think the typical pamper pander that lives off the earnings of the prostitute is usually a consensual arrangement. Although it's quite often his wife, perhaps under Section 4.
It's a great sentence in the commentary on page 25. Society views such conduct as grossly disruptive to the sanctity of the marriage and the stability of the home.
That's like, that was written a long time ago.
Section 4, in effect, restates existing ordinance law. 167, 125 covers coercing a female to engage in prostitution at a 5-year maximum. 167, 115 covers placing your wife in the house of prostitution with a 10-year maximum. We've extended that to include child or stepchild. 167, 135 covers procuring a female under 18 for prostitution. That carries a 10-year maximum.
Mr. Chairman, I move we approve Section 4.
You've heard the motion. A second.
I second.
All in favor, pardon me, any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, would this, what if a fellow was a pimp and married his, the gal he was pimping for? Would all of a sudden he be guilty of compelling?
No.
Okay.
If he continued to
why? Why
operate
would he
after the marriage, yes.
Hi.
What if she did voluntarily?
She's now his wife.
All
and
right.
She is now engaged in prostitution.
Did he cause her to go into prostitution after they were married, or was she in
before? Before. They were. He was her pimp before. And
yeah, if she says, I want to quit, and he says, well, you do. Then he is good.
Yes, then he was.
No, I don't think so.
Oh,
he hadn't used his voice to engage
in
prostitution.
He continues to pimp for her, even after they're married. Yeah. Now, this
well,
is not a figment of my imagination, either, because I know some cases like this.
Well, I
don't know what your friends are like.
I know strange people.
You might provide for an affirmative defense that your wife was a prostitute before you married her.
What if he were able to show that it was her wish? He didn't induce her. He said, well, I don't want you to continue. And she says, well, I want to continue.
Get out of the house and find me a customer.
I don't think that it would... if she was engaged in prostitution prior to the time of their marriage. The way I read this, if they're married, and then he induces or causes her.
Well, I see the fairness. I think there's, but I don't see the fairness the other way around.
I don't think this covers the other situation.
I think there would be, have to be an additional act of inducement after the marriage.
I do too.
I think so.
Well, I think there almost would be jacked an inducement of some sort.
Well, it's section 6.
The way I read the act here, it would be.
I would remove the privilege, but yes. Why?
What's that, Frank?
Well, we don't really define prostitution. We define what a prostitute is, so I assume that prostitution would be an act committed by a prostitute, and so that I would think that it would be covered under non-situation where the marries his prostitute, she then becomes his wife, and he would be covered under the language.
Well, had he used force? Had he used intimidation to compel her to continue?
No, you don't have to use force.
Or did he induce or cause his wife?
Well, when he goes out and gets the girl gets the guy and brings him home for his wife, that's causing his wife to engage in prostitution.
That's sure. Isn't it?
I mean,
he's aiding her.
To me, you got it in here. If you don't want it, it should be changed.
Don, was your question, did you assume that the husband would continue to go out and bring men into his home?
Yeah. There have been cases, a number of them that I can recall from when I was sheriff, where guys actually married the gal who they were pimping for and would continue to pimp for them. And the gal would continue to work in her trade.
Well, society views such conduct as grossly disruptive to the sanctity of marriage and stability of the home.
Actually, the guy was doing better by the gal by marrying her, you know, than he was by just continuing to bid for her. He really
gave her a raise.
Yeah.
Well, I think causes his wife, if he procures the man from the outside, perhaps it's covered. Because he's knowingly doing it.
Now, where does the privilege come from?
It doesn't.
Privilege is written out.
Written out.
Section 6.
Oh.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I have one question. Does would Section 3, could not Section 3, in a proper case, apply to a wife?
Sure.
In other words, wives aren't ruled out of Section 3.
No.
We're not discriminating.
No. So does the enhanced penalty apply?
I never saw such a commission to have little phone messages and drag them away.
I can't make a
motion. Your instructions, Chairman. I move to adopt Section 4.
Is there a second?
It's the second motion.
Senator Jones, moves. Second. Is there any further discussion?
Now, on Section 3, should that be, should the causes his wife or husband? As long as we're recognizing male prostitutes, what if the wife is out hustling for the husband?
But we haven't.
Isn't that disruptive to the marriage?
You want to change wife to spouse?
The sanctity of the marriage and the stability of the home to have the wife.
Wouldn't hurt anything. Would
do you want to change that to spouse?
Well, I just tried.
Wherever
the word wife appears,
we change the word wife appears, we change it to spouse.
Yeah,
making that in the form of a motion?
I want to see where it appears.
Well, Roger's commentary indicates that it wasn't used. The term spouse wasn't used because it seemed, the subcommittee, I think, felt it was highly improbable that a wife would be causing her husband engaged in prostitution.
Yeah, but there are some circles in Multnomah County that we're hearing about today.
Now a mother is covered under 7-3 as a child.
Well, do I understand that wife appears only in Section 4 in the prostitution? That's the only
Section 6.
Well,
that would be the only one.
Yeah. Do you want to make that in the form of a motion, Frank?
I think there's another, yeah, I think there's another reason for it too, because when you say, although when we use the term he, we're talking about a man or a woman, but when we use induces or causes his wife, child, or stepchild, there are going to be courts that are going to throw out a charge on the mother.
No, not when they read the commentary.
Well, we give in the commission here great weight to the commentary, but the courts will give it later.
Well, you find some knockheads that won't read it, sure. But you find knockheads right now.
That's why I'm concerned.
Speaking about knockheads, you ought to read the commentary on the obscenity statutes. Who's remarks about the judges? There's about three paragraphs. New York judges.
Lieutenant Callie moves that we change the word wife to spouse. Is there a second?
Second.
All right. Any further discussion? If not, answer with your favorite answer, I and your name shall call.
Judge Burns?
No.
Senator Burns?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carson?
Aye.
Chairman?
Aye.
Clark?
My problem's resolved. Everybody agreed?
What is your problem?
What is your problem?
Aye.
Frost?
No.
Sanders?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Nine?
Aye.
Spaulding?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Okay, passed. Section 5.
There remains a motion.
Sub 3 of Section 4.
And then is there a motion to pass Section 4 as amended?
We've got two of those on the floor.
Question.
All right.
Could we sometime have an answer to the felon's question about whether his question is answered?
Yeah, it's all taken care of now.
It's covered.
It's covered.
Yeah.
We don't know which way.
If it continues to pin 4, it's covered.
Boy, he is covered.
At least number 3 would be a lesser included crime, wouldn't it?
Yeah, right.
Section
3. By marrying the girl, he's now guilty of a more serious crime.
Yeah, he'd be foolish to marry her.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, she may
have. I'd say he's foolish to anybody.
Having determined the practicality of the thing already, now we're going to make it illegal.
I don't think you should punish somebody by getting married.
We're not punishing him for getting married. We're punishing him for disrupting the fabric of that marvelous institution which he's just entered, which we sanctify.
Don, as I understand it, assuming that he's
moralizing the code.
And guilty of pimping, and then he marries her.
And he continues to pimp her.
And he continues to bring guys to her and pimp for her. Then he is guilty of a more serious offense. However, if he marries her and stops pimping for her, and she continues to engage in prostitution,
he's not guilty of anything,
because the fact that he initially induced her to go into it. Doesn't rise to the dignity of this offense. But if, after he marries her, he continues to pimp for her, he would be guilty of this. And I think there's a rationale that justifies raising this to a higher level.
He might be possibly guilty if she brings home the money that he lives off of her, whether he pimps or not, under Section 3 of 3.
Right. I think that's the point that we ought to look at, is Section 3, and the question whether he should be guilty under 4. Now, if she is engaging in this because of her husband and she would not otherwise be engaging in it, then maybe you'd have some argument to charge him under Section 4. But otherwise, I think you've got the situation amply covered under promoting prostitution, which would be a less serious crime, even though he is in fact married to her.
But a very aggressive DA might try him under 4.
If that sort of conduct doesn't go on, right?
We're married to him.
there would be a lesser, three would be a lesser included.
Sure.
I really can't at all. Well,
I know some else people.
Question.
All right, question called for. All in favor of the motion to approve section 4 as amended, say aye as your name is your call. Those opposed, no.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Sandra Burns?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Hanover?
Aye.
Clark?
No.
Frost?
Aye.
Drinstead?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Spaulding?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
All right, carried. Section 5. Might say that, well, perhaps Judge Burns will have something to say with respect to police thoughts on this particular section.
Get that next.
Section 5, page 27. This is a corroboration statute. There's a typo when they refer to sections 4 and 6, that's intended to be 4 and 3.
Three and four,
not section
6. Should it be 3 or
4?
3 and 4. Yeah. Right. Instead of 3 and 4. Yeah, right. 3
or 4. On your third line, section 5. Page 27. Should it be section 3 or 4? Is everybody agreeable to that technical amendment?
Oh, if I move to strike session.
Didn't hear you.
If you move to strike session. I missed the technical amendment before I heard his motion.
3 or 4 instead of 4 and 6.
Okay.
So the section will read, a person shall not be convicted under sections 3 or 4 of this article solely on the uncorroborated testimony of the person whose prostitution he is alleged to have promoted or
compelled. Yeah.
All right. This does create some change in existing law in Oregon. ORS 167-140 requires corroboration for the crime of inveigling, enticing, or taking away an unmarried female for the purpose of prostitution. That is the only present prosecution statute that requires corroboration.
Commentary, Wigmore's second complaint wouldn't hold an argument. The points that you make on our Wigmore's evidence, the second one wouldn't apply in Oregon, would it?
But you have, the court has the power to not let the case go to the jury. Make it hard to if there is some substantial evidence.
It's a direct verdict motion.
Yeah, but you deny the motion if there is some substantial evidence, however unbelievable to the judge, wouldn't you?
Well, provided the evidence rose to the dignity of proof beyond reasonable doubt.
If it's substantial, can the trial judge say whether it's beyond a reasonable doubt or whether it isn't? Is that always for the jury?
Oh, I don't think it's always for the jury.
I've done it
a few times.
Well, is that because it's in the field?
Well, perhaps.
Well, we're on section 5. Section 5?
Well, I had a case just the other day, Bruce, where in effect I did that. It was tried without a jury. It wasn't a prosecution case. And at the close of the state's case, the defendant moved for a directed verdict, and I said, granted. And the deputy DA was just horrified. He said, all of the inferences are supposed to run in favor of the state. I said, that's agreed. That's correct. But all of the inferences don't necessarily have to add up to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And if they don't, then that motion ought to be granted.
Or the facts.
Yeah, but I don't think you can say, as a matter of law, where there is evidence that is substantial, I don't think as a matter of law the court can say that that does or does not add up to beyond a reasonable doubt.
Why not?
It's a reasonable doubt, it's a quantum of proof.
It's like what's in the juror's mind.
Well, correct. Right.
But the effect of the evidence.
Well, if there was any evidence at all, how could you grant the direct?
Because
they did appeal.
Not out of district attorney's applauding.
But if that were the case, then you'd sit at, in every case, and after all the evidence, and you were sitting and decide whether you felt that the state had proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt before you even let it go to the jury.
And you wouldn't be deciding whether there was substantial evidence. That would be the
first of your overriding. You gotta let it go to the jury.
You better
tell
you
have to.
You gotta let it go to the jury. It's just, like, please, like, just, like, just like a directed verdict in a, or a non-suit in a civil case.
Exactly.
If in fact that quantum of proof, whatever the evidence is, if it doesn't add up to what a reasonable mind could conclude is a preponderance of evidence.
Well, isn't the judge then evading the duty of the jury and making the determination as to whether or not there's a preponderance of evidence there, or in a civil case, or beyond reasonable doubt in a criminal case?
That's what we're doing here.
That's what the jury's function is.
The judge also has a function.
What is that?
The referee is sold.
I'm not saying that sometimes you think that we don't do a just thing by doing that, but I think you do, and then you. But I also technically, under the law, you can't, except for the right of the field. I had one in Judge Davis's court where all the same is said, it just doesn't convince me or anybody else to get a reasonable doubt that there is some evidence. And he took care of it by giving every damn request and instruction I had, including those that were comments on the evidence.
Do you submit that type of
request? I do, if I think the judge might give him.
Did we pass on section 4?
Yes.
Well,
I think we have it.
Determination, because only in one, I think one or two of the present statutes covering pimps and so on, encouragement and promotion, do we now require corroboration? In most of them, we do not. And this would require corroboration in all of them. And I'm not so sure that that's sound to me.
What was the motion? Well,
he moved to delete Section 5.
Well, Section 5 doesn't bother me, except having adopted Section 4, 7, 3. That's the one that... Because in that case, in those cases, you're hardly ever going to get uncorroborated testimony. I would think... Unlikely to in many cases. And
you're hardly ever going to get corroborated.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. And it leaves you open to some pretty serious blackmail.
I know that we can take that. Where is this? What's the derivation?
New York.
We discussed this at some great length with the police officers, and the thing that they were particularly concerned about was the element of corroboration. They thought that you should be able to prosecute a pimp or an offender under any of these sections on completely uncorroborated testimony. And I suppose for consistency's sake, inasmuch as we did away with the false token in the OMFP section, our first act, we would go that route. I think maybe a halfway approach is perhaps your suggestion, Jim, is or as I will, simply because these people that are testifying on both sides, the prosecution witnesses, they're awfully, awfully unstable, the reform whore or the mad pimp that's testifying against his competitor or justice does require an element of corroboration in some of these cases. But I don't know. I think.
What was your
intersection? A very legitimate case, and that's all you've got is that you got one witness and
testimony of the girl.
Convincing.
What was the
child?
Well, I think
yeah.
The jury. I think you get it sometimes.
Look at the note I got.
Well, you were kind of suggesting that we keep it the way it is in the existing law.
Well, the existing law has certain variations, which we've essentially continued, except we've cleaned up the wording and made them subsections and so on. My notes indicate that one of the things the police officer said when we talked to him, and we spent quite a little time of our meeting talking to him, one of the suggestions was if you have one witness plus strong circumstances. Well, this is a terrible job to draft. I don't know what you mean by strong circumstances. Or one witness plus some type of habitual activity that might be gotten in. But all of these really kind of beg the question, I suppose you'd say. And they themselves pointed out that you do have a danger on the lack of corroboration, because if the gal gets embittered and tries to use it as a blackmail tool, it can work that way. But on the other hand, so often they'll try to delay these cases and to work on the one witness. And it's asking a lot in this type of a prosecution to have two witnesses.
It's an organized vice, and it seems to me to put a tougher burden on the state in this area than probably the most legitimate area of prosecution in this area is when you are getting a real organized vice.
As I read this, one person and strong corroborative circumstantial evidence would be allowed. Am I wrong?
Yeah,
well, sure. But if you framed it in those terms, you'd make it tougher on the prosecutor than this section is now.
Does this contemplate that every element of the crime must be corroborated?
No, I think just the classic test for corroborative evidence, and that is evidence, any evidence that tends to connect the defendant with the commission of the crime. That's all you need.
Well, Frank, what do you think?
Physical evidence?
Well, you say the testimony of two witnesses now. This was a term that they were talking here. You have two witnesses. I mean, what if they are both prostitutes? I mean, if he's running two of them are going to testify against him. This is a question that I've always had in my mind. I had a situation where I just about had to try it once or twice. It's kind of two accomplices corroborate each other. Not really. And so that
Well, of course, what you do in that case, though, is you allege
one. This is worded a little differently, because you allege one, and the other prostitute couldn't corroborate. But
this prostitute, you got to remember, is not an accomplice to the commission of the crime of promoting or compelling prostitution. She wouldn't be an accomplice under our existing law, and she wouldn't be an accomplice under our accomplice article.
But for purposes of corroboration, this would make her an accomplice, simply for the purposes of corroboration.
Yes, it would.
Well, you asked me with my feeling on it. It seems to me that as far as when you have the danger, why you want corroboration is you don't want some buddy getting somebody that isn't just picking somebody out of the air and saying he's the one that's put me up to it. And it seemed to me that as far as the motive of the prostitute and anything else would come out as far as the jury, and if it were a case that smelled that way, the jury's going to turn them loose anyway.
You have it today, don't you? You have a requirement for corroboration today. You need Biglinger, Enticing.
You have the
not on receiving in the area.
Under one statute only, encouraging.
Yeah, begging. The more I think about this...
I'll vote for these.
The more I think about it, so you got a guy that's charged with receiving earrings, and you have the girl that testifies that she committed this, and the only thing that we're asking in order to corroborate her, maybe the testimony of somebody that saw the girl with the guy, or something that can connect him. But if she comes in, if we eliminate this, she can just come in and say on such and such a day, this guy, I did a trick for so-and-so and gave the money to Joe. And there's no testimony showing that she was together with the trick or that she was together with Joe. And you have to lift the case.
Easy to accuse and hard to disprove.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we'd make it more clear if we just leave it as it is, add on that in the absence of some other evidence tending to connect the defendant with the grand charge.
Pardon, please.
Just add on to it. In the absence of some other evidence tending to connect the defendant with the grand charge.
A person shall not be convicted.
Well, it already says that. I say just leave it as it is totally. Except change the period at the end to a comma.
In the absence of
some other evidence tending to connect the defendant with the crime charge.
Well, is that anything?
I don't know.
Well, that's what it means now.
Look at the other side of this thing. You're talking about, it seems to be one of the areas you're really talking about here, with the sanctity of the home. But really, you are talking about an area where you've got the more or less professional type criminal involved. It seems to me to put a higher burden on the state in this area than you do in the other areas. It just doesn't make sense.
Not if it's I don't think.
I think that you've got a witness up there.
What it is?
She's a prostitute.
You can't get for a few amount of his time.
It's the only testimony you got. You've got an awful rough hole to go.
Well, Lee, you've got that burden today.
Well, I agree with you that burden today. Yeah. And as a result, we don't do much in the area of prostitution.
Well, the burden today exists only in the
inveigling
statute, and not in the others, and there are half a dozen pandering type statutes.
Four and six. What is four? Four is compelling.
Three. That should be three
should
or four.
Should we change that to three?
Oh.
Yeah, three or four.
Three or four.
That's the one. Well, you don't need a lot of corroborative evidence.
Well, the present statute on corroborative evidence of an accomplice says, unless it is corroborated by other evidence that tends to connect the defendant with the commission of crime.
Well, that's what Bruce said.
Corroboration is not sufficient.
And it's those words that permit the court to say you just need something.
Well, the test in the accomplice situation is, you got to show enough.